Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. I don't know about you, but there came a moment for me when the phone rang and 9 times out of 10, it was a robocall. Despite being on the do not call list, and perhaps because of being on the do not call list, my number never seemed to stop ringing with unwanted calls. The North Carolina Attorney General's Office reports citizens received more than 10,000 robocalls in North Carolina in 2021 alone, and that number is apparently quite low. These calls center on auto warranties, Social Security, loan offers, and many times are nothing but scams. The Federal Trade Commission believes last year Americans lost $158 billion to fraud and scams because of robocalls. But these callers aren't just targeting individuals. They're also targeting government officials and agencies at all levels. So who are the perpetrators? Can they be stopped? This hour, we look at how to protect yourself and at how our state is leading the charge to end these damaging nuisance calls. We're joined by Adam Dupe, who's an associate professor at the School of Computing and Augmented Intelligence at Arizona State University. He's here with Sam Sabin, a cybersecurity reporter at Axios and author of the weekly Future of Cybersecurity newsletter. Good morning to you both. Welcome, Sam.
Good morning.
Good morning, Sam. I'm told that you, even though you don't live here anymore, grew up listening to this program.
Yep, I did live in Charlotte through high school. And good news for you, Mike, I graduated yesterday. So no worries at all.
Thank you for that. I appreciate that. So before we start, I want to mention that we reached out to North Carolina Attorney General Jeff Jackson about joining the program and received an initial response of interest, but subsequent emails went unanswered. So we hope to have him on the program in the future to talk about this and other issues facing our state, because he's a very activist attorney general. Adam, just to make sure that we're all on the same page here, define robocalls, and specifically the ones that we as ordinary mortals should be concerned about.
Yeah, great question. So robocalls are any kind of essentially usually unwanted calls where somebody is calling you. Usually the robo term comes because it's using some automated system to do the dialing. And it also usually has some computerized voice that is telling you that your warranty of your car is up, or whatever kind of that hook part of the scam is to get you to engage in that. So this is, it's also one of those things you shouldn't even need to define, because if you have a phone, you get hundreds of these a day.
And I guess, Sam, it doesn't really matter where they are coming from, just the fact that they keep ringing your phone. But where are they coming from? Are they mostly onshore within the United States or North America, or are they coming from elsewhere in the world?
Some of them come from onshore, but a lot of them are coming from overseas. And that's what makes it so tricky to crack down on it. We're talking about, you know, call centers in India or scam compounds in Myanmar, near Thailand, et cetera. And so it's definitely like an international operation that just keeps growing and growing and growing.
And Sam, are these all bad actors, the people making these calls? I mean, if you say yes to something or somehow get hornswoggled into participating in what they're selling, is it necessarily a bad thing, or is it always a bad thing?
Oh, that's a great question. I'm wary of saying that it's not always a bad thing, because I think it's probably, you never know what's going to happen until they want you enticed in the phone call and engaged, right? But typically, yeah, they're pretty bad actors, or at worst case scenario or best case scenario, maybe just looking for money and or they're looking for intelligence, depending on who they're calling.
Adam.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, it's really interesting. Like, we've done some in-depth research kind of trying to collect these robocalls and then trying to categorize them, seeing what's out there. And we kind of see that they fall under two kind of categories. One of telemarketing that seems to be using unscrupulous methods to try to reach out to people and kind of lead gen for companies. And on the other side, just straight scams that are trying to steal. And a lot of times it's actually like Medicare related scams where they're trying to get not just your, you know, traditional, what we think of as scams is social security numbers, credit card numbers, but actually like Medicare information. And then to add a third point, another thing that we found, we did a very initial study a while back where we actually tried to interview the scammers. So they would call us and then we'd say, hey, actually, we'd love to interview you for a research study. And it turned out a lot of them didn't actually think they were scamming. Like they, I think, worked, you know, normal jobs that they just, they, wherever that call came in. So once you're past that robotic phase of the call and you talk to a human, I think a lot of times that's just lead gen for these companies that they're paying shady people that are doing this. And then these people are just normal people trying to do their jobs. So yeah, it's a really interesting ecosystem.
I'm sitting here looking at the two of you, and Adam is an associate professor at Arizona State, but he's young. And Sam is a cybersecurity reporter for Axios, and she is young. And Sam just mentioned Medicare, and a lot of these calls are Medicare scams, which doesn't concern people your age at all. But I'm curious about people your age in general. Does this even concern them, Sam? Because it seems to me that people your age don't use the phone to talk to people with their voice. They use it to text, they use it to scroll, they use it to be on social media. Is it as big a concern for them because they don't use the phone part of the phone?
Right. I want to challenge that as someone who talks a lot on the phone with my friends, not just for work. We're using the phone. We're using it intentionally, but it does still concern us, right? I don't have the exact numbers in front of me. Adam might have them. The FTC does an annual report. They put out, you know, big numbers around how much Americans lost to fraud, et cetera. Last year, like, there were more people who were ages, you know, in the younger demographics who lost more to fraud than those who were maybe in the older, you know, 60 plus group, right? And a lot of that, I mean, it comes from not just the phone on, you know, the way that I would maybe pick up the phone, call my parents or whoever. It's coming from text, right? You're getting, I just got one this morning. It is 7 a.m. where I am today. And I woke up to a text from someone claiming to have this amazing job opportunity for me. And they're a recruiter who's going to change my life. And if you are someone who is unemployed right now, that might sound amazing if you don't know about this fraud that is going around. And so it's pretty easy even for young people to still fall for these and get tricked up in this.
Yeah, that, so 12.5 billion is the number, Sam. So I looked that up while you were talking. And it's very easy to be thinking that, well, scams are something that other people fall for. But I will admit, a scam got me at exactly the right moment. It was an email came in right before I was going to go on the plane. They were impersonating the dean of our college. And they said, hey, you know, I have something really important. Can you do something for me? And I had just got off the phone with them and we were talking about something that couldn't be put under phone. So they said, hey, can I call you? So I said, yes, here's my phone number. And they replied back. They said, great, give me a bunch of gift certificates from the Apple store. And I go, oh God, I can't believe I sent these scammers my phone number, right? Like, you know, it gets you. And that's part of why we all get these scams, because they need to cast this wide net so that they can get those few people that are in that vulnerable situation. Just like Sam said, the people that maybe lost their jobs recently that are looking for jobs. So it really does, I think, affect all ages.
Sam.
Yeah, I would also add to that anecdotally. I mean, I've been at Axios maybe 3 years now. In the first few weeks, it uncanny. Maybe they knew I was hired. You know, the world doesn't revolve around me. But a bunch of our employees started getting texts from our CEO claiming that they wanted to have a meeting, right? That Jim VandeHei was ready to meet with me, Sam, and I, what a time. And if you're an employee who of any age, right, and you get a text from your CEO saying, hey, let's meet, you're maybe excited, you're maybe nervous, you are eager to do whatever that person is telling you to do. And typically it does result in a gift card scam. They go, well, before we meet, can you, like, I really need an Apple gift card? And that's usually a tell, right? But people fall for it. It's scams are everywhere. They're happening all the time.
Well, talk to me about these gift card things, because if somebody calls you and said, what if, for whatever reason, whatever story they tell you that sounds legitimate, and then they suddenly say, well, go to the Apple store and buy me $500 in gift cards, or go to wherever, Walmart, and get me gift cards. Should that be the red flag that stops the whole conversation? Should that be it for you? Don't do that.
Yes. Simply okay. Yes. I know this is radio yes. And I should have more of a answer.
No, that's fine. You, yes is fine. Yes.
It still works, right? And mm-hmm. and typically, yeah. It sounds really easy. Like if you are in your car, your home right now listening to this, you're like, oh, well, why would I ever go to the Apple store and get a $200 gift card for someone over and over again? People are building a relationship with you, right? They're texting you for a really long time, or they're on the phone with you. You're doing video calls. I've heard stories of job scams where someone did a full like video recruitment, like interview, right? They thought it was real. And then we're told, hey, to buy your laptop or to get your laptop for work, you need to go get an Apple gift card so that we can purchase it, which sounds fishy. But mm-hmm. at that point, if you really need a job and everything mm-hmm. else is checked out, maybe this company's just weird and you want to try and do it, and then you lose thousands of dollars to, yeah. So don't buy the gift card.
Yeah. So the Adam other, I was just going to say the other type of scam that's also, you know, it doesn't involve gift cards. All the scams need to monetize. I think that is important to try to kind of break down, right? They need to somehow get a hold of you. They need to get your attention, and then they need to make money. And one of the big ones is these investment scams, where they basically say, hey, you should check out, eventually after establishing a repertoire with you, they say, hey, you should check out this website. I'm making a ton of money on crypto with this website. You go to the website, you invest money, you see your portfolio doubled, you put more money in, your portfolio doubles. But of course, you've now been giving your money to scammers. This website is completely fake. None of the numbers are real, and they've taken all of your money. And this is where you see the really high value, $100,000, $200,000 scams.
So it's 2025, Adam, and in 2019, you wrote an op-ed piece for CNN in which you said that technology was not close to being able to handle the robocall problem. That was in 2019. Are we any closer today?
Maybe. I hope not. I don't know. It's one of these things. As a technologist, as a computer scientist, right? And I study cybersecurity. Part of my job is to make technology. And at the time, in 2019, there was this big push. One of the key things that as a technology person, I was shocked when I studied the phone system is the caller ID numbers that would show up were essentially just extra information that was sent along with the call. Nobody checked that you actually owned that number. It was just sent. And this is why, if you remember back then, it was such a big problem, what they called a neighbor spoofing, where you would get a phone call with almost your number, but a few digits different. And the way that they were able to do this is because it was trivial to make phone calls changing that caller ID. Well, there was this big push to say, hey, let's use cryptography. Let's secure these numbers. Let's make sure that that number is authenticated. And at the time I was looking at this saying, yeah, but there will still be scams. Like even if the caller, like people will still answer phone calls from a number, even if it's verified. And I've even seen this now, where scammers are weaponizing this feature, and they somehow get, I still don't know how, but they get a name that is called Chase, and then they call me and they're impersonating Chase Bank, or they get a name that says Google and they call me and they're impersonating Google. And so now and we've seen this time and time again. Criminals are very smart, which is why I love the area of cybersecurity. You have this active adversary you're working against that always finds clever ways around the defenses that you put in place.
I actually got a call on my cell phone from my cell phone. The caller ID had my cell phone number on
yeah.
it at one
point. Yeah.
It's, wow.
But I answered it because I wanted to know who the heck was on the other end of the phone.
Exactly. Yes. That's exactly what they're trying to play into, right? It's like psychologically, how do they get it so that they can get you in there?
So much to talk about. We haven't even scratched the surface. We'll take a break. We'll come back with more with Adam Dupay with Arizona State University and Sam Sabin with Axios in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcharlotteregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking today about robocalls, both calls and texts, which are usually bad news for the people receiving them. And we'll talk more about that with Adam DuPay. He's an associate professor in the School of Computing and Augmented Intelligence at Arizona State University. I could use some augmented intelligence this morning if you could pass it along. And
me
Sam
too.
Sabin is with us. She is with us. She is a cybersecurity reporter for Axios and the author of the Future of Cybersecurity newsletter. I think at the very beginning of the program, I said that the Attorney General's office reports that citizens here received more than 10,000 robocalls in 2021. Those numbers sounded very low to me. And perhaps that's accurate, but certainly the number of those calls has increased substantially just in the last 4 years, because in August, Attorney General Jeff Jackson posted a message on Facebook talking about the actions he is taking against the perpetrators of these calls. We couldn't get him on the program, but he is on Facebook. He's on social media everywhere. And here he is on Facebook talking about the problem.
We get 200 million robocalls a month. That's not the whole country. That's just North Carolina. As a country, we get about 5 billion a month. The vast majority of them are illegal and just trying to scam you. As Attorney General, people will stop me in the street to tell me to go after robocalls. So I'm changing our tactics to make them more aggressive.
So he goes on to list on the screen, because this is a video, the 37 telecom companies the state is taking on to rein them in. And he goes on to explain the complexity of the problem.
By the time your phone rings, that call has gone through 6 or 7 different telecom companies. You pay a monthly bill to one of the big 4 telecom companies, but there are a lot of smaller ones you've never heard of. And every call to you gets passed down by those smaller ones like links in a chain. And among all those companies, some play by the rules and do what they're supposed to block robocalls, and some look the other way, pass them along. What they're hoping for is that there are so many of these companies that no one will bother taking them on. Well, they're wrong about that.
Mm-hmm. And he explains how he took on at least one company successfully, drove it out of business, and hit it with a $5 million fine. And he put those other companies on notice a little bit later on in that video. So, Adam, is this an effective strategy? Can this work?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think going after the supply of people making these robocalls can definitely have a dent. I think when you look at the whole ecosystem and you have these companies that are run overseas, it's a lot harder for me to envision how a single state can maybe impact these and solve the problem completely. But any reduction in the amount of robocalls and the amount of scamming towards people, I think, is a great benefit.
But Sam, it sounds a bit like whack-a-mole. You go after one company, maybe you put them out of business, maybe they just go bankrupt and reincorporate under a different name and continue. Maybe they pay the $5 million fine he spoke of, maybe they don't. But it's like whack-a-mole if you can find the mole to whack. How would you describe it?
You read my mind, Mike. It really is whack-a-mole. I think Adam brought up a great point earlier. I have a wacky brain, and so I find it intriguing and fascinating. But one of the maybe upsetting parts about cybersecurity and especially scams is just how quickly these threat actors, people in this ecosystem, can adapt, right? They constantly, and this is not just true of scams, it's true in ransomware, it's true in phishing. Like, there is constant tearing down and rebuilding of the various organizations that are a part of the cyber criminal ecosystem. And that is true of scams. And so it really is whack-a-mole to just like go around and try and find everyone piece by piece.
Our attorney general, Jeff Jackson, talked about suing 37 or going after 37 telecom companies. When most people think of telephone companies, they think of AT&T, they think of Verizon, they think of T-Mobile. I can't think of a single landline company anymore, so I don't know. But he's not talking about those companies. How do these companies work? Explain, Sam, how these companies work. What does it take to start one of these companies? And given they're probably all over the world, do we really have any control over them?
I'm going to lean on Adam's expertise here in a
Okay.
second, but my understanding is that a lot of these, I mean, a big chunk of them, and I know it's not going to be exclusive, are like the voice over internet providers, right? So think of like Google Voice. That's probably the biggest one that we all think of, where you can just go online, you use your Gmail account, and you can get a phone number pretty easily, right? So a lot of these are operating in that regard rather than through maybe the very set in stone like Verizon, AT&T networks. But I'm sure Adam has more to say on that,
Yeah,
network there.
that is where definitely a lot of this stuff comes in, is these VoIP providers, mainly because it's so easy for the criminals, because they can just offer a service. Like, the VoIP provider isn't the one doing the scamming themselves. They just provide this service. They're lax on checking, and scammers use that service. They
Can they
do
be
need
held
to.
res can the VoIP providers be held responsible?
It's a great question, and it's something I've been thinking about. Maybe, Mike, if I can ask you a personal question. How many spam emails do you get a day, do you think?
Tons.
Tons?
I can't qua well, I have several email accounts, most of which I use for that exact purpose. Just to, if I have to put my name in for to sign up for an account someplace, I put it in that account that I never use. So I don't really know the answer to that, but I get a lot. Yes,
Okay, do you have a
tons.
Gmail account at
Yes, I
all?
do.
Okay,
Yes, I
so
do.
Gmail, in my opinion, is pretty good with email spam filtering. Maybe a few gets through a day, but if you go look through your spam folder, you can see the hundreds of spam messages that these systems catch. So something I've always been thinking about is why email spam, when email is a newer technology, right? We're able to fight the email spam much better than robocalls, because it's kind of a similar thing, right? Somebody's trying to reach out to you and get to you. And there's a lot of differences, but actually one of the key differences that I always think about is when you get a phone call, right? Somebody had to pay to make that call. We talk about the telco companies. Somebody had to pay to make that call, and everyone along the way who took that call got paid, right? But when Gmail is getting an email, no, Gmail's not getting paid for that email. So actually, Google and Gmail and email providers have a very strong incentive to aggressively block emails and do email spams. Whereas a lot of the large telco companies we're talking about don't have a financial incentive to block these things. And so there's, I think, less of pressure for them to actually try to really solve this problem, because they can point to somebody else and say, well, we got it from the it's this other telco that's causing the problem, so go after them.
Because if somebody sends you an email, until you delete it permanently, it sits on their servers at Google and takes up space. Well, I guess that's their it's financial incentive to limit the number of things sitting there forever. Some say, Sam, that if you have your phone number in your email signature or some other place online, that these companies can harvest that number and use it. Are they doing that, or are they mostly randomly dialing numbers till somebody picks up the phone?
It's that. It's also think about every single time you have added your phone number to any account, any marketing information, right? Maybe you added, I did this a few weeks ago, maybe you added it to an app so you could get a free birthday treat, right? We're doing this, and then companies are selling our data, right? They're doing it left and right through third-party data brokers. There are probably troves and troves of databases that are traded legally among various companies, and then it just ends up on the dark web. My email has been the same for years. My phone number is still a 704 number. I should maybe change it, but it's the hometown. It is super easy. It goes beyond just if you put it in your email signature and it's there to be collected by whoever. It is so beyond anything that I think people can even do operationally to keep their phone number out of harm's way. There are just so many different avenues and places that people can find this data and collect it and piece it together.
One of the early solutions, and one that gave a lot of people hope, was the Do Not Call registry, Adam. You could put your number in the registry, and theoretically, robocallers could not, should not, would not call you because they could be fined for calling somebody on the Do Not Call list. Did that work? Or did the mere fact that you put your number on the Do Not Call list result in them saying, okay, we're calling that person. There's the number.
Well, I think, Mike, if the do not call list did work, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation today about this topic, right? So, but it's important, just like you said, to understand the reasons why, right? It started from this very good thing. And I think the do not call list does help, but for kind of a narrow slice, right? It helps from stopping receiving calls from legitimate companies that are following the rules, right? A good company will check this list and not call you for any kind of marketing, right? But what I think at the time people didn't realize is it's the unscrupulous people, either unscrupulous telemarketers that aren't following this list or the straight out scammers who are, you know, conducting malicious harm. They will use the fact that you're on this list as a way to know that A, there is a person there, so I should call this number, and B, nobody else is calling them, so maybe it's more likely that they'll pick up my phone call.
So if you have these dialers that make multiple phone calls at the same time, just to random, whether they're random numbers or targeted numbers, the calls are going out until somebody picks up the phone and then it routes it to a live person or to a computer that then routes it to a live person. Mm-hmm. That's expensive, it seems to me. Would it be safe to say then, Sam, that the return on investment for whatever expense you put into that is much greater than the expense?
I actually don't think it's as expensive as we all think it is, right? We have to think about also maybe the operational costs and the living costs in a lot of the countries where this is happening, right? The cost for operating something in India and Thailand and Myanmar is way lower than maybe, you know, what we're used to here in the United States with our higher cost of living. So, and then add that to the fact that there are estimates out there, our reported estimates of the $12.5 billion that people are losing every year, and it really just adds up. Like, people are making bank that over the 5,000, 1,000, 20,000 people that people lose to each scam.
A couple of years ago, 2023, I think it was, Sam, you wrote about something that was new at the time, which I'm sure has become or will soon become even more greatly used, and that is using generative AI to make voice scams more believable. You say that cyber criminals need as little as 3 seconds of your voice, of anybody's voice, to successfully clone it and then use it to make you for scam purposes. What are you talking about? Explain that to me, because my voice is out there every day. Your voice is now out there. So is Adam's. So talk to me about how this is being done. What's being done with this information?
Yeah, the three of us are not in a good position, even by being on this episode. I mean, we are in a good position. You're welcome, Charlotte, but happy to be here. But it's super simple, right? It's we're maybe an outlier, but if we're talking about everyday people, there is a reason why sometimes you answer the phone and there is a pause, right? You don't hear a voice and you go, hello, hello. That is enough for someone now in generative AI, using generative AI tools to maybe record that, or maybe they scrape YouTube if they really want to impersonate me. I have talked enough in public spaces, unfortunately, that they could scrape my voice, create a whole AI model of what Sam Sabin sounds like, get me to say different things. And it sounds in audio pretty scary real at this point, right? There are certain maybe tells or intricacies. Maybe you hear me talking in this model, you go, well, Sam would never say that word, but you'd have to really know me to know if like that wasn't right. And so it doesn't take a lot. And then so AI kind of builds the model from there.
So once they clone you with this voice model, how are they using it?
Yeah, not in great ways, Mike. Think about maybe the classic scam that's been happening in the last couple years. I think it's called the grandparent scam, right? And maybe I'm conflating names of scams here, but I'm thinking of the ones where you get a call from someone claiming to be your granddaughter, your grandson, and they are in a bad situation. They need money right now. And typically what would happen before is maybe, you know, it's an automated voice or a scary person who's like, I have your granddaughter or grandson here. They need money. Now it actually can sound like them calling you very realistically saying, grandma, please, I need $2,000 to get out of this bad situation. And it's pulling at our heartstrings, right? And it makes it more realistic.
If I read your article, I think it's your article that I read this in, if they can respond to you in real time because there's somebody listening to the response coming from grandma and typing into the computer, and the computer spits it out in your voice.
Yes. Yes, in real time. And that, we're still even early days in AI and the
Wow.
capabilities that we have here. So imagine that getting better and better.
During the last presidential campaign, one company sent deceptive calls, Adam, to New Hampshire voters using artificial intelligence to mimic the voice of Joe Biden, falsely suggesting that if you voted in the presidential primary, you would not be allowed to vote in the general election in November. They not only caught the telecom company that was allowing this to happen, they caught the political consultant who orchestrated the calls. How effective is a scam like this? And is it likely to happen again, given the fact that they caught both the telecom company and the scammer?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think to really answer that, you'd have to understand what was the outcome they were looking for. And one of the things that's important to remember, as we all know in these elections, is sometimes it can take only a few votes in certain counties to actually change the overall vote. So even if you're, and maybe that's worth $5 million or however many, $10 million fine to a company and organization. So you hope that these rules would deter people because you want people to play fair and you want it to be in a nice playing field. But yeah, it's a giant big problem.
Well, Jeff Jackson, our attorney general, spoke about finding companies sending these robocalls out, finding them $1 million. And in this case of impersonating Joe Biden, the FCC proposed to fine Lingo, the telecom company, $2 million. They settled. They paid the $2 million. They proposed to fine the consultant $6 million. As a sidebar, this consultant, Steve Kramer, admitted to sending these fake Biden messages to thousands of voters and would have faced decades in prison on charges of voter suppression or impersonating a candidate. But in his defense, he said he did it to send a wake-up call to about the potential dangers of AI. His defense was that the voice never identified itself as Joe Biden, and Joe Biden's name was not on the ballot. He won the primary as a write-in candidate. And because of that, the jury acquitted him on all counts. He still faces the fines, but as of June of this year, he says he will not pay the $6 million fine. And in fact, the FBI started warning people in May of a campaign of AI voices impersonating other government officials, urging people to click on links that could infect their computers. We'll talk about that and how these robocalls and texts are now targeting not just government agencies, but the people who work in them. We're coming right back. We're talking about robocalls and worse on Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the Gambrill Center at Queens, presenting Earthwise, a public series exploring our connection to nature through science, film, art, literature, and lived stories, part of their Connected Campus program. More at gambrillcenter.org.
Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about robocalls with Adam Dupay, associate professor in the School of Computing and Augmented Intelligence at Arizona State University, and Sam Sabin, cybersecurity reporter for Axios and the author of the Future of Cybersecurity newsletter. That example I just gave about the caller, the AI-generated voice of Joe Biden calling people and saying, don't vote in the primary because if you do, you cannot vote in the general election, seems ludicrous on the face of it. The fact, A, that Joe Biden would make that call, or Donald Trump would make that call, or anybody else in high government would make that call, sounds ludicrous. The idea that voting in the primary, which specifically is set aside to choose the candidates for the general, would eliminate your ability to vote in the general, is just dumb on the face of it. How effective are things? Because there are other things that are like that are going on right now. How effective are these? Do we need to? What do we need to do about that? Because that's general education.
Yeah, something to really remember, and this is why maybe, I mean, email phishing and scams still work pretty well in the cyber criminal world. A lot of this is built on trust, right? We were taught that we could trust the phones that we have, that we know the phone numbers to pick up the phone. Maybe it's your school calling, maybe it's your hospital and health insurance people. You know, we are told that the things that are coming through our phone are probably better than what's coming through our junk mail or email phishing. And there are scammers who are taking advantage of that. And we can try and educate our way out of it, but it hasn't really been working for various reasons that I think we've been laying out. Yeah.
Adam.
Yeah, I think, yeah, one of the key things when you think about, you know, how can people protect themselves? Because we are entering this world, just like you said, Mike and Sam, that you may get a phone call from somebody in your close family, your parents, your wife, and it could be an AI bot that somebody has created by cloning their voice. So one of the key things, like we said, you have to be very careful about any time if something seems fishy, stop is one of the key things. The other thing is, if you're ever in doubt about a bank calling you, or like Sam said, the hospital or anything like that, hang up and call that number back from the number on their website or the number that you already have, right? That is one of the best ways to get to them. And the third suggestion that I have is something that I've actually implemented in my family, probably actually looking back at one of Sam's articles when this first came out a year or two ago, was a family code word. Like, we have a code word that if somebody in the family calls you and needs money and is in trouble, they better say that code word, otherwise they're not getting anything. And I won't say what it is on air, obviously.
Oh, I was going to ask you. That was my next question.
Mike, I'll give you whatever you want. You're a great guy.
And it isn't just individuals, just ordinary people being targeted. It's people who work for government agencies and the agencies themselves. The FCC is in charge of all this. They police all of this, allegedly. And earlier this year, employees at the FCC were targets of this, Sam. You write that they regulate telecoms, they issue rulings to force them to do the right things and make their systems more secure. They were targeted. Over a dozen FCC staff members and their families were targeted by robocallers claiming to be from the fraud prevention team at the FCC. Well, the whole FCC is a fraud prevention team. And they demanded the recipients pay $1,000 in Google gift cards to avoid jail time for a made-up crime they didn't commit. Well, if I made a if I'm if I committed the crime, it would seem to me, Sam, I would know that I'd done this. And if I didn't recall committing that crime, why would I ante up $1,000 in Google gift cards? Why would I fall for that?
Right, that's a flaw, right? That's a clear flaw in the scam. But it's maybe similar to when we get calls from the IRS, right, saying, "Hey, you didn't pay your taxes, or you messed it up, and now you're being audited, and you have to pay all this extra money." And that's a scam, right? It's usually the IRS is not going to call you; they're going to stick to classic mail if that's the issue. And it's probably similar with the FCC. They're playing in or to that FCC scam. They're playing into fear. You're in doubt, right? Maybe you didn't understand the rules. Maybe you did that one thing where you sent an email and it ended up being a crime. Oh my God, now I'm going to go to jail. I'm spiraling, right? And it kind of carries on from there.
Adam.
Yeah, just like to add that there's a really interesting phenomenon that people have hypothesized. So scammers have limited resources, right? They can't spend all of their time trying to scam everybody. So there's this theory that they actually make their scams intentionally look scammy. And like if you remember the Nigerian prince scams over emails, like, when is a Nigerian prince ever going to email me? But the theory is they have limited resources to scam people after that initial phase. So they would love to get rid of the Mikes and the Sams that immediately trigger this as a scam. And they want to just deal with the people that's afterwards. And even if it's only 1% of the people that they call get to that next stage of their funnel, now they know they have a target-rich set of people that they can scam.
Well, here's something else that they do, evidently, that I read about yesterday that maybe makes you more susceptible to falling for it, Adam. And that is in the case of the FCC that Sam wrote about, they mention your name at the top of the call. Mike, Sam, Adam. And if somebody's going to call you by name, clearly, they must know something about you. Maybe this is legitimate, but then they ask you to press 1 to speak to a live person or 2 to get a call back. How common is this? And if you are asked to press 1 to speak to a live person, Adam, or press 2 to get a call back, they're going to ask for your number, I would imagine. But should you do that, or should you just hang up?
Great question. It gets into a lot of things. So in general, one of the other good things is just don't engage with these calls. Like, they do keep track, because they have limited resources, right? They keep track of people, that numbers where people answer the phone. So if you stop answering, you're actually less likely to get calls. And then the other important thing is, this targeted information happens all the time. You just triggered a story, Mike, in my mind, where I got a really panicked call from my mom, who, she received a physical piece of mail to their house with her name on it, saying that they've hacked into the computers and that they know all the nasty stuff that they're doing and yada, yada, yada. And I was like, whoa, this is really crazy. Cause exactly like you said, Mike, it was targeted. It was to their house with their name. And I started thinking, I was like, wait a minute. I started Googling around for that address, and you can see who lives at, you know, who bought the house. And that's probably what they used. And the other defensive thing that I didn't mention earlier is, if you're ever in doubt, just like you said, like, Google for these things, search for these things. You look at keywords of the scam of the messages. This is why there's so much information out there that the FTC and other people like Sam put out about the latest scams, that once you see, like, oh no, and that's what I did. I looked at it and I said, oh no, this group is just randomly targeting people. They actually don't have anything on you. They're just trying to get you to pay some money because they think they can use exactly the fact that they know who you are and where you live as information to trick you into thinking that they've done something.
It also occurs to me that perhaps, maybe I'm wrong about this, correct me if I am, that older people might be more susceptible, because we grew up at a time before voicemail, before answering machines, before caller ID. So when the phone rang, you answered it because you didn't know who was on the other end. And it's, for me personally, it was a hard habit to break. If the phone rang, I was going to answer it. I don't, if I could be eating dinner, didn't matter. The caller ID would pop up. I don't know what 513 area, I'm nobody who lives in that area code, but by gosh, I'm going to answer it because it's the phone. Yeah. Well, what's the rule of thumb? If you don't recognize the number, don't answer it. Let it go to voicemail. And if it's important, they'll leave that voicemail.
Yeah, there's that. I'd also, maybe sometimes I Google the phone number to Adam's point, to see if I actually, like, maybe it's connected to a name, that maybe it's connected to someone at work whose number I forgot to save or something like that. Right. So there is a great campaign out there from Craig Newmark and some of his partners. He's the founder of Craigslist. That's called Take 9, right? It applies to any cybersecurity issue. Take 9 seconds. Just pause and see, like, okay, before I just like pick up the phone and like answer it, do I actually know this phone number? Should I Google it for 2 seconds and then call them back? Just pause, and you'll be shocked at like how much like the immediate panic that we have kind of subsides.
And it isn't just people calling you on the phone. We're now getting an increasing number of text scams, which I understand have gotten harder to identify and more costly for consumers. Last year, I think I read that Americans lost $470 million on scams that began as text messages. What can you tell us about that, Sam?
Oh, man. It's a lot of the texts that, think of all the scam phone calls that you were getting, and now they're via text, right? I have gotten ones for jobs. I've gotten ones for maybe my toll payment is overdue. I live in the Bay Area. We have many tolls, so that is possible. Or maybe, you know, there's a parking seat.
Is it possible? Because if you live in the Bay Area, I mean, we have toll lanes here now.
Yeah.
And if you use them regularly, you would have an easy pass.
Right.
Easy Pass bills you, and you get the bill, or you feed the kitty and it deducts it from your bank account at Easy Pass. Yep. If you don't have Easy Pass and you use it, it reads your driver's license and it sends you a bill in the mail. So if somebody calls you and says you owe back tolls or unpaid traffic tickets, wouldn't you know?
You would hope. Right? Life is so chaotic. I have no idea. But this is why it's important to take pause, right? To actually think about it for a few seconds before you then click on the link that's in the text. And a lot of these scams are really trying to prey on the fact that we are all living such ridiculously busy lives. Maybe you're just trying to get your kids out the door and you're going to soccer practice and it's been a nightmare. People are having meltdowns. And then you get this phone call and you're like, oh, I'll just pick up the phone and see what happens. Or you just get an email and you see it and you're like, oh, that must be legitimate. And you click on the link. Just take a beat and maybe verify when you're in a calmer spot when possible.
Yeah, 11 states, including North Carolina, have warned about these toll and traffic ticket scams. Another of these text scams comes from allegedly from mail or package carrier impersonators that appear to be alerts with alerting you to problems with the delivery. It's stuck in shipment transit someplace, and they need more money from you to get it out of there and get it to your house. And there's a link in the email that you click or in the text that you click. What happens when you click?
This is exactly, and you can see they're preying on all of our worst fears, right? It's like you ordered something on Amazon, it's for a project that you're doing or a party that you're setting up, and you're like, oh no, the worst thing in the world is if this package doesn't arrive. And so you click without, like Sam said, you don't take those 9 seconds to think, like, wait a minute, UPS or FedEx doesn't like text me like this out of the blue. But you click on the page that takes you somewhere else. It's a scam website that probably looks like UPS or FedEx, right? So this gets into the realm of kind of standard web phishing attacks, where they then, you know, they have this fake payment system that tries to pay, and either they'll actually charge you money, or they'll just steal your your credit card information and then use that to commit fraud somewhere else.
Yikes. Adam, Android phone users can forward text they believe to be scams to spam. Apple has something similar, I believe, and some wireless carriers do as well. Are they effective? If you forward these texts to spam, what happens to them? Are they investigated? What happens?
The great question. We actually have a research paper where we looked into exactly this issue, because we felt like as consumers, you're inundated with all of these calls, texts, emails. You know that they're a scam, but what can you actually do to fight back? Right? How do you actually improve things for other people? And so we looked at several things, but specifically to answer your question, when you had a text message, this actually was one of the best ways and the fastest ways that that websites get blocked. So what happens is that email goes to Apple or Google or whoever. They then look for links in there, like we talked about, that link to the fake shipping page. And they will analyze it and say, oh, looks like that is spam. And then Google will actually block it, push that out to everyone's browser and everyone's on their computer and everyone's browser on their phone. So that if future people click on it, they'll actually get a big red scary warning that blocks it. And so that's one of the best ways you actually can do something and help combat these scams.
Sam, you reported recently that more than 80 leaders from the public, private, and nonprofit sectors are calling for a whole-of-government strategy to crack down on all of this. Where does that effort stand, and is the whole of government listening?
They released it about a week ago, and as you may recall, the government promptly shut down last Tuesday. So unclear where those efforts stand. My understanding is that this was a group of people. It's across, you know, payment companies like Visa or telcos, and the AARP is involved, but then also government agencies, including not only this effort started under the Biden administration, but also current Trump administration officials are also a part of that effort. So there is interest, but it is unclear. Washington moves kind of slow on this. Yeah. From my perspective, it always feels like they're moving slow, and all of a sudden there's a week where this is the big important thing. All of a sudden, cybersecurity is top of mind, and they have all these announcements. So stay tuned. It's possible that there's progress, but there is bipartisan interest in cracking down on scams.
Adam, are there third-party apps that you can put on your phone to block the calls and or the texts?
Yeah, there are third-party apps that you can install. One that comes to mind is Nomo Robo, which I just remember because it's a great name. But there's a lot of them. And what they try to do, this is also what's so hard about phone call and robocall blocking. If you think about the difference, again, like I mentioned, between an email comes in, and Google can actually read the entire content of the email. They know what's trying to be sent. They can see if they're trying to sell you Viagra or whatever the spam email is trying to do. Whereas with a phone call, all you have is the number that's calling, and that's it, right? You can't inspect the content of the call because you need to answer it. And so these systems usually try to rely on databases of known scam numbers, and they can block one. So it is great. It'll usually alert you that, hey, this is likely a scam. And so it's a good additional defense mechanism. But one of the important things I'd urge people is don't think because you have this, you're 100% safe and you can answer every call that goes through.
I had a great final question that I do not have time to ask, and that is, what's in the pipeline? What should we be on the lookout for next? I'm sure it's more nefarious than anything we've been talking about so far today, but that's a topic for another show. We're out of time. Adam Dupay, associate professor from the School of Computing and Augmented Intelligence at Arizona State University, and Sam Sabin, cybersecurity reporter for Axios and the author of the Future of Cybersecurity newsletter, who grew up listening to this show. Now she's been on it, she can retire. Thanks for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.